Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. Join us in a vibrant conversation about the constant struggle to find balance between the demands of their careers and their relationships with money, family, and personal freedom. This isn't just about money. This is about life. Now, here's your host, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. We should know that personal finance isn't about being rich or getting rich quick. It's about buying independence and freedom of choice. You are not alone as you struggle with being the perfect wife, mother, daughter, daughter-in-law, and all the other traditional roles assigned to us by our cultures. These pressures can feel overwhelming, and when we add the demands of a career on top of it all, many women choose to pass on dealing with money issues until they're forced to. And that's not the best time to learn. Here we explore the stories of women and how they've handled the demands of finances, family, and career. We talk about falling short of perfection, but also about the lessons we've learned and the best advice our peers have to offer for financial security and putting our perceived failures in their proper place. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Linda Hollander. Linda Hollander has been featured by Inc. magazine as the leading expert on corporate sponsorship. She is the CEO of Sponsor Concierge. Her corporate sponsors have included Microsoft, Wells Fargo, Dun & Bradstreet, Citibank, FedEx, HealthNet, American Airlines, Bank of America, Staples, Walmart, and another small company called IBM. She consults with people about how to skyrocket their businesses, nonprofits, projects, and events with the awesome power of corporate sponsors. She lives in LA, California, with her husband, Leslie Greenfield, and their various rescue cats. Welcome, Linda.
Great to be here, Lynn.
Good. I'm so glad you're here. I'm so excited to talk to you today about so many things. And let's start first with your business, the Sponsor Concierge. Because I sought you out a while ago at the suggestion of a friend who said that if there's anybody that knows anything about corporate sponsorships, it's Linda Hollander. So let's start with, how did you get involved in something like this? How did you go from no sponsors to all these Fortune 500 companies? Take us through how that happened.
Hey, okay, we got to know. So when I started my first business, I mean, it was just a total life-changing event. I'd been in jobs and I couldn't keep a job, and I was wondering, like, what the heck is wrong with me that I can't keep a job, that I have this resistance to authority, that I want to blaze my own trail, that I want to strike out on my own. And the minute that I started my own business, I said, oh, that's what's wrong with me. I'm an entrepreneur. And as entrepreneurs, yes, as you know, we are completely unemployable.
We are. We're a totally different breed.
Oh, totally different breed. Totally different. Yep. So I'm going to give you a little bit of backstory because when I started my business, I mean, it was great. You know, I was able to travel the world. I was able to kind of live life on my terms. I was able to express my creativity completely and fully. And it was so great. But you know what? Before I started my business, as I mentioned, you know, I was in a series of really bad dead-end jobs, and, you know, it just was not working for me. You know, my soul was crying out because, as I said, I had the fire of an entrepreneur, and I just couldn't express that. I was basically buried in terrible debt because while I was unemployed, I borrowed money on my credit cards. And of course, you know, being the power of the purse, that you don't do that. But I was, you know, young and didn't know any better. So I borrowed a lot of money on my credit cards when I was unemployed. And every day when I went down to my mailbox from my little rent controlled apartment, it was just a reminder of my financial failures because my hand would shake when I opened that mailbox, because I knew that there were bills in there that I could never, ever afford to pay. And I just could not see the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm in Los Angeles, and I had to drive and fight traffic to get to my office. And when I got there, I had to really work with people that I didn't like. And a lot of times I just went in my car and I ate lunch by myself. And I had an abrasive relationship with my boss. And, you know, on a personal level, I was in a relationship with an abusive man. And that relationship lasted for, oh, God, I'm embarrassed to say, but it lasted for 4.5 years. And what led me down that path was that I had absolutely no self-confidence. I mean, it was like worse than the gutter. And I thought basically that that was what I deserved. But, you know, fortunately, Lynn, one day, I hadn't met you then. I wish I did. But one day I did have an epiphany and I said, I don't want to live as a victim anymore. I want my life to make a difference. So I fired my boss. I dumped the abusive boyfriend, and I called my best friend, Cheryl, and Cheryl and I met at recess. We were 13 years old, standing there in our little bobby socks with our little lunch pails, and, you know, we just became so close. We came bonded. We were closer than sisters, and we knew that if one day we did something together, it would be phenomenal. So I quit my job, she quit her jobs, and we started a business, and you're going to love this, making bags. And it wasn't ladies' purses, but it was custom-printed shopping bags in paper, plastic, and canvas. And our clients for that business were little companies like Disney and Mattel and Sears and Nissan. And we grew this silly little bag company into a multi-million dollar business. So then I said, you know what? I want to teach other women to do what I did. You know, oh, and by the way, 3.5 weeks after I dumped this abusive guy, I met my husband. You know, so all Yay. The good things in my life happened to me, you know, and I paid off the debt and I, you know, did all this cool stuff, you know, and my husband is the kindest, the most gentle person in the world. You know, when we met, he had a 20-year-old cat, so I knew he had to be a decent person to raise a cat to 20 years of age. And I was the original cat lady. So, you know, it was kind of meant to be. So I wanted to help other women do what I did, you know, have better relationships, send their kids to better schools, learn how to start and succeed in their own business, you know, really get power through entrepreneurship. So I got this crazy idea in my head that I wanted to do the Women's Small Business Expo. And at this point, I was not in the bag business anymore. I was just kind of off on my own, you know, working from my kitchen table. I was a micro business of one person, but I wanted to do this amazing big event for women to empower them. And I knew that I needed something called sponsors to make it happen because we're all taught to have big dreams, but we're not taught how to fund those dreams. So I said, you know, I looked at other conferences and there was something called sponsors. And I said, well, what do these sponsors do? And I found out that they give you money and they give you resources and they underwrite, you know, whatever you want to do. So they basically help you fund your dreams. So I researched it, and my very, very first sponsors were Bank of America, Walmart, and IBM. And this was me working from my kitchen table, sharing it with the cat, you know, and it was just one person with one idea, and I got all these sponsors. And then everybody would come up to me, and they'd come to the events, and they would say, well, great event, but how are you getting these sponsors and how can I get sponsors too? So that's why, you know, for the past 17 years, I have been helping people get corporate sponsors, you know, people with an idea, you know, people just getting started, people who've been doing it for a while. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Good. Because to me, there's a gap there. And I have to ask you this because I'm thinking, what are my listeners thinking as well? You said you started the business and making the bags, first of all, your first business.
Yes.
And then you had people like Disney and whatever and Bank of America. How did you get from somebody who had a very small business to somebody who could appeal to corporate America?
Okay.
How did you not get lost in the shuffle?
Well, you know, we started with smaller accounts. We started just kind of walking around to local businesses and saying, hey, do you need bags? You know, because, you know, promotional bags, you know, are so great. Promotional items, you know, they increase orders. They increase the frequency. A bag is a walking billboard for your business. And a lot of small businesses couldn't afford it because you had to order, you know, thousands and thousands of bags. So we figured out a way they could order very small quantities, like a couple hundred bags, and really start on their way to growing their business, you know, through this amazing promotional vehicle, which is a bag. And so we got small accounts. And then we kind of, in Los Angeles, you know, we kind of got known by this one lady in the entertainment sector. So one of our first big accounts was Universal Studios. So we did what's called an overprint of this bag that we did for Universal Studios. We printed more than, you know, the customer ordered, and then we sent the rest to the local production companies, the local studios, the local entertainment companies, and we sort of got known in that particular arena because we did this one job, and we sort of leveraged it to get more. And then, you know, one thing led to another. Disney found out about us. Mattel found about us. Sears found out about us. Nissan. We did a lot of, you know, trade shows, special events, movie openings, as well as the traditional retail. So, you know, somebody's got to make those bags that you see in the shopping malls, and that's what we did.
But now, just again, I'm just going to play devil's advocate here. Aren't there a lot of other companies that make bags? What was it that you were doing that was so different?
One of the things that was different about our company is that we were one of the only women-owned companies in America who made bags. And the company name was the Bag Ladies. And the naming ourselves the Bag Ladies, oh my God, made more money for us than, you know, hiring a Madison Avenue advertising firm.
That is perfect.
Yeah, and we added personality. You know, we put our photos there. You know, we were young. We were cute at the time. So we put our photos there. We gave it personality. We gave it story. And, you know, at that time, we did direct mail to get our first accounts. You know, we bought lists. We did direct mail, which was the thing at the time. And then after every account that we completed, we sent out a little survey card, and we asked for a referral. We said, okay, you know, you liked what we did. Who else do you know that use this great service and some great bags? And that's how we grew the business from absolutely nothing.
Now, isn't that the thing that we're always taught to do? You're always supposed to ask for referrals at the moment when everybody's really thrilled and happy. And how many of us really do it? I mean, there's an issue. It's very basic. Very basic marketing. So kudos to you that you actually did that. That was smart. Tell me another thing about why did you make the transition from that company into becoming a consultant to women businesses? Didn't you see more opportunity for the first company, or did you just say, I'm done with that, I'm on to something new? How did you get to the second business?
Well, the way I got to the second business was, remember I said I wanted my life to make a difference. And, you know, being one of the only women-owned packaging firms in America at the time, you know, we attracted a lot of women business owners, you know, and it was so rewarding. It was so rewarding to see their businesses grow, because one of them, her name was Connie, and she owned a company that made cookies. And she started with small orders, and then she got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then, you know, I'm driving down the street, and she's on a billboard, you know. It was so great to see them. So these, you know how women are when they get together. They didn't just order bags from our company. I mean, we would talk, and I knew kids when the kids were graduating from whatever they were in, high school, college, whatever. I knew their anniversaries. We knew these customers because we didn't just order bags. You know, we got to know them on a very intimate level. And I loved that part of the business. I loved when women would come to me and say, Linda, please help me. How do I do sales? How do I do marketing? We had those kind of conversations. It wasn't just, oh, I'll order this many bags, goodbye. You know, we had those kind of conversations. And I realized that was where my heart and my soul was, that I loved to help other women build their businesses. I loved it.
Great. So did you start with certain organizations of women business owners? Did you join them to let them know you were going to do this?
I joined everything. I hit the pavement big time. And you know what? I got to let you and the listeners know that I am an extremely introverted person. I mean, you know, none of my teachers from school remember me. I never raise my hand. I'm a very petite person. I'm not even 5 feet tall. So I could hide behind the football player in front of me in class and never get noticed. You know, and people that hear what I'm doing now, they think, oh my God, that's got to be another Linda Hollander, because I wouldn't even talk to anybody. But you know what? My motivation was so strong. My motivation to succeed, to move out of my little rent-controlled apartment, to buy my first home, which incidentally I did. I bought my first home as a single woman. You know, to really take charge of my life was so strong that I forced myself to do these things. So I went to NABO. I went to NAFI. I went to eWomen Network. I went to, you know, if it has initials, I was there. And I forced myself to talk to people, you know, even though it wasn't really comfortable for me. It got kind of comfortable after a while. I also had this terrible, terrible fear of public speaking. And I've been doing public speaking for 20 years now. And you know what? I realized once I started it, oh, my God, it is so fun. It is so fun. Now I'm addicted to it.
I never heard anybody say they were addicted to it, but I've heard some people say they enjoy it. But I think that's great. I understand what you mean, because I have done public speaking too. And there is a certain kind of high that you get when you're doing this and you really think you're making a difference to people. And that's the part. It's that, to me, it's watching their faces get something that they thought was something they could never understand. And when that light bulb goes on, that to me is worth everything. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Oh, that is so true. It's the connection with the audience, you know, like when you see the light bulb, you know, that light come from them, you know, and you're seeing, oh my God, they're really getting this. I'm giving them hope for the future. I'm giving them information that they're going to use to make their lives better. I mean, there's nothing better than that.
Well, let me go back, you know, to some of the motivators that you just, excuse me, talked about. And you said you were so committed to not being in that rent-controlled apartment and all the other stuff that was part of your life. What was your family life like when you were growing up?
You know, in some ways, I had a nurturing paradise. I had a traditional nuclear family, very loving parents. My father and my mother were both amazing people. You know, but my mom was a stay-at-home mom. She was a traditional stay-at-home mom. And, you know, I saw what happened with that relationship and the imbalance of power in the relationship. And, you know, very early I decided that was really not for me, that I was really going to always being, you know, have income, always being creating income, whatever my situation, whether I was single, whether I was married. You know, I never really wanted to have fights over money. I never really wanted to have issues with money, you know, because I know that destroys a lot of marriages, a lot of relationships. Yeah. So I saw my parents' relationship, even though they had a pretty good relationship, when it came to money, when it came, you know, there was a big imbalance of power there. And, you know, I just was observing that and saying, you know what, you know, that this is great for them, but it is not good for me.
Okay. And so what lessons about money did you learn when you were growing up?
What lessons did I learn? Well, I remember once when I saw my parents fighting, and it was a terrible fight. It was just really bad. And my mom stormed out of the house. And, you know, I was left with my dad. And, you know, I was just so afraid, you know, of what would happen, you know. And my dad said, don't worry, you know, well, everything's going to be fine, you know. And, you know, I was thinking, like, what is my mom going to do if, you know, she's not married, if she's not being supported by a man? Because that was so much a part of her. You know, she never really worked, you know, she worked for like a few years when they were married. But after the kids came along, she never really worked outside of the home. She was not a well woman. She was always sick with one ailment or the other, which was really interesting because she lived till 82 years old. And I never thought that was going to happen because she was always in the hospitals and she always had something or another. And I was just so scared. And, you know, I said, I just didn't ever want to feel that feeling again of being scared, of being not in control of my financial circumstances.
So how old were you when you got your first job?
I was a teenager, you know, like most people when you get your first job. And I had the typical teenage jobs. I am not a natural born entrepreneur. I think I want to tell that to people because, you know, when I sold Girl Scout cookies, if I did not have family and their friends, I never would have sold any. I didn't go knocking door to door. I didn't do all this aggressive stuff that the girls do today, you know, to sell their Girl Scout cookies. I had to learn entrepreneurship, you know, and that's the thing. We always hear like, we always hear these stories of entrepreneurs that on the schoolyard, they would buy a candy bar and, you know, break it into pieces and sell the little pieces for profit. I never really did that. I just had the traditional jobs, you know, in food service. I had jobs, you know, in an optometrist's office. You know, I had the traditional jobs that you have. One of my first job out of college, I was here's a cool thing. In college, all I took was art classes. All I took was art classes. I thought business was completely boring because everybody who saw me draw or everybody who saw me paint as a child said, "Oh my dear, you have to become a professional artist." And I was good at it, and it was my passion. So I got an art degree, and then one of my first jobs out of college was in an art gallery. And I learned – that's where I think I really blossomed because I learned sales and I learned how to do sales. And I learned that I had a knack for sales. And I had a very encouraging boss at the time. And he said, you know, I really like the way you treat your customers. You know, even if a painting is $25,000, you'll say, oh, well, it's only $25,000 and it's an investment. Here's how we could do the payments and here's all the benefits of buying this particular artwork, you know. And
Well done.
Thank you. And I knew that if I knew how to sell, I could do anything. I always would have job security. And then, of course, I would always have security in my own business because I think when people start businesses, and this is men and women, a lot of times they'll start businesses and they'll be really scrappy when they're first starting that business and they'll go out and they'll sell and they'll, you know, beat the pavement, you know, but then the business gets successful, the business gets some money and then they hire out the sales and they don't get in touch with the sales anymore, you know, because they outsource it to other people. I always think you should really keep in touch with the sales and the marketing of your company.
I agree.
Yeah.
What's been the most threatening to your financial security?
The most threatening to my financial security was really looking in the mirror and seeing that I had a lot of limiting beliefs around finances. I had a ceiling about what I can make and what I can do in this life. And thank God, early enough in my career after college, I started doing seminars. I was the seminar junkie. I did real estate seminars so I could learn how to buy real estate, with nothing down or low down and become a real – and I own a real estate now. I went to all kinds of course, entrepreneurship and business seminars to learn how to sell, to learn how to market, to learn how to do bookkeeping, to learn, you know, all that stuff that you don't even like to know but are necessary. And so I think my mindset was the biggest stumbling block of all because, remember, I thought business was boring. I thought it was for other people. I didn't think it was for me. So I think with a lot of people, your mindset is really what's holding you down because a lot of people think, you know, it's outside influences like the economy and, you know, all that stuff. But, you know, really the biggest threats to you and your business are you and your mindset. And there's another thing that's really threatening to you and your business and your success. And that is the people that you hang with. If you want to be successful, you have got to be around successful people. And I learned that very, very quickly. You cannot be around the same group that you've grown up with, even though you're comfortable with them. You've got to break out of your comfort zone and really hang with a better class of people because you cannot fly with the eagles if you're down on the ground with the turkeys. So that was another impediment, was just the people that I was hanging around and their beliefs, that permeated mine. And so once I started that, and that's why I was the seminar PR queen because I wanted to hang around with visionary people.
Yeah. And when you first said you were doing seminars, I thought you meant you were actually, you were the one giving them. And then I thought, no, you're the one, you're attending them.
I was attending them. And of course I attend so many. I made notes of, okay, I like this they're doing here. I don't like that. And so when I started to do my own, I had so much experience as far as being in the audience, being in the attendee section, you know, that I could really, you know, kind of, I kind of knew a lot just by going to all of them.
Mm-hmm. That's invaluable experience when you think about that. You really feels like to sit in that audience and listen. So that's great stuff.
Oh, and I was the butt of jokes of all of my friends. They all made fun of me.
Oh, I'm
said,
sure.
Okay, the weekend's coming up. What seminar are you going to? But, you know, you can't listen to that stuff. You know, you just kind of got to power through.
That's right. I think you're absolutely right. I think I was a seminar junkie, but not necessarily physically at the seminars. I must have 20, I guess they call them books of cassette tapes. That's how long ago. For Tony Robbins and of them. You know, I love them. I thought they were great. So what are the events that have happened in your life that you would describe as defining moments? I think we already talked about some of those, but don't let me put words in your mouth.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's go into the sponsor arena, because one of my defining moments was when I got my first sponsor. So let me tell you how that worked. I want everybody here to look everywhere for who could possibly sponsor you, because let's remember, I'll paint the scene for you. I was out of the bag business. My business partner, who is still my best friend, understood that I had to move on and do other things. She was so gracious about buying me out and everything. And so I'm out of the business and I'm at home, you know, just kind of working, you know, thinking of all these, you know, at that time were thought of as crazy ideas. The one that I could not let go of was the Women's Small Business Expo. It was the first thing I thought of in the morning, the last thing I thought of at night, you know, and it just, you know, took up all my thoughts. So I'm driving, and of course, I'm in Los Angeles, so guess what? I was in a traffic jam, and I was cursing that traffic jam. I was really
That's
cursing.
That's unusual.
But I look up on a billboard, and then there's the Bank of America billboard, and there's a woman on it. And I was doing a Women's Small Business Expo, and I said, oh, wait a minute, what if they could be my sponsor? So here's how the mind works. You have this great idea, and then your second idea is to self-sabotage. So my second thought in my head was, oh, God, you know, I'm just a nobody. They're never going to talk to me. Why would they be interested in me? I'm going to make a fool of myself if I approach them. You know, I'm going to feel terrible. I'm going to fail. You know, that's just kind of how the mind works. So for a while, I just kind of put it off. But it wouldn't stop in my brain, this thought that I should approach Bank of America to be a sponsor. So finally, I got my nerve up. And I made some calls, and I found the right person to call at Bank of America. I had my proposal going, already written, and I set up a meeting with this guy at Bank of America. And I drove to that meeting, and what really motivates me is what I call the girl power songs. I put on all these girl power songs when I'm driving, and my favorite one was I Will Survive, because in some ways that's kind of my life, you know. So I'm playing I Will Survive, I'm singing to it, and I get to the office, and then I come in, and I was so nervous. I mean, thank God there was a desk between us, because my knees were knocking, and, you know, and we, you know, I showed him my proposal, and he says, okay, well, we'll go for this level of sponsorship. I can't really reveal exactly what it was, but he said, okay, we'll go for this one. And I had to act like I did this every day. So I said, okay, great. You know, thanks, Steve. His name was Steve. And I got up and I had to wipe my hand on my jacket. I wore my one good suit, you know, you got that one good suit. I had to wipe my hand on the suit, you know, before I shook his hand. I got in my car and oh my God, I did the happy dance in my car. Thank God nobody walked by. And all the way home, I waved to all the Bank of America branches because I had got my first sponsor. So that's really an experience that really, you know, changed the trajectory of my business, because that led to other sponsors. It led to IBM and FedEx and Staples and HealthNet Insurance and Southwest Airlines and, you know, all these great companies. But it all happened. It all started with that very, very first sponsor. And so that was a pivotal experience for me.
What about, you also mentioned earlier, there's two things that you came up against where you said you were tired of living your life the way it was. And you, from that moment forward, two things happened. You decided you were going to start doing something with the bag lady idea. And secondly, you ended a relationship that was, for lack of a better term, toxic. So those were two really important defining moments in your life as well. What was it that Yes. motivated you to say, I'm just going to do this?
Well, as far as my relationship, and thank God, you know, we never got married. Thank God we never had kids. I had to hit bottom. You know, they say you got to hit bottom.
Yeah.
We were you know, on a trip together, and, you know, we were with a friend of mine, and he was being really abusive, and it was public at that point, you know, because, you know, when you're in this kind of an abusive relationship, and by the way, it was not a battering relationship. It was an emotionally abusive. But he did it, you know, in front of this friend of mine, and, you know, I saw my relationship through her eyes for the first time, through somebody else's eyes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I made up my mind at that time, this is it. And, you know, it was really interesting because I always thought, you know, if I love somebody, I'm always going to love them. But people could do things that are, you know, such atrocities that you stop yeah. loving them. So I just cut it off totally. I cut off that relationship when we got back in town and never, never, never looked back. Now, the second half of the question was the wealthy bag lady business?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
What made you start? Where did you get to? At what point did you say, I'm tired of living like I'm living and I'm going to start this business?
Okay.
What motivated
well, a
you
similar thing-
to make that switch?
A similar thing happened in my job. I kind of had a Jerry Maguire moment in my job. And you've seen Jerry Maguire, right?
Yes, I'm laughing. Okay.
So remember that scene yep. when he, you know, well, I guess he didn't quit. He was kind of pushed out. You know, there wasn't yeah. the fish tank there. I didn't take a fish. But, you know, in my job. Okay. So remember I said that I had an abrasive relationship with my job, my boss. Well, he comes yeah. to me and he says, I'm moving in with you. I'm going to be in the same office as you. And I said, oh, my God, this is it. I cannot take, you know, being in a fishbowl. Well, I guess a fishbowl with this guy all day and being in the same office. You know, if he was in another office down yeah. the hall, fine. You know, and I that day I said, this is it. I'm leaving. And I had no other job to go to. But I said,
wow.
This is it. This is when this I know this is the time for me to make my exit.
And so, you know, those are two, as you said, a friend of mine always said to me that change will only happen when you've reached that point where you just can't simply take it anymore. And mm-hmm. we all know what that point is. And when you hit
yeah.
it, you know it, and it's time to move on. So that's great. I'm glad to hear you say that there was a moment there that just – for most people, that's how it works anyway. But some people mm-hmm. will stay in relationships. I'm not talking about a personal relationship, but even business relationships. They stay in them where they're painful. They're very painful to stay there, but people feel like it's the devil I know versus the devil I don't know. And to stand in nothing like you did is really courageous. I mean, to say, I'm just
it's
done.
Courageous.
I don't know what's coming.
I don't recommend it for everybody because my business partner, like, you know, when we started our business, she stayed in her job for a little while, you know, and she
okay.
sort of phased her way out of it gradually. And that was
okay.
best for her. But I found, you know, that when you get rid of all that negative stuff in your life, all that negative energy, you allow the positive to come in. So I got rid
yeah.
of my, you know, this toxic relationship with the boss. Okay. And then I was able to really start my own business with nothing else distracting me. I was single-mindedly focused and lasered on making my business successful. I got rid of an
right.
abusive relationship. And then that's why 3.5 weeks later, I met my husband, because I got
yeah.
rid of the negative so the positive could enter, you know, and that's just what works for me.
I just think that's a very refreshing way to look at it, because I don't think too many people think about it as being you move the negative out so the positive can come in. Most people say they move the negative out and then there's nothing. And I think that's so wrong, because I agree with you. The energy has got to come in. Yep. Let me ask you another question. Do you ever see yourself being retired?
You know, I heard Zig Ziglar at one time. You know Zig Ziglar, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
I do.
You know, the
great
Zig Ziglar, I saw him a few times speaking. If people don't know who Zig Ziglar is, just kind of Google him, because he was just one of the most gifted speakers and motivators on this planet. He is sorely missed, and I have a photo with him that I will always, always treasure. But
that's
he,
great.
In I think in his 70s and his 80s, he said, "I'm not retired, I'm refired." And I really loved that so much. And sometimes it is all about languaging, you know, and how you language things. And I said, that is me. I'm never really going to be retired. I'm going to be constantly refired. So if I get tired of doing something, if it's just not working for me, I'm going to be doing something else. I'm always going to be working in some capacity as long as my brain holds out, as long as my body holds out, because I need a purpose, a reason to get up in the morning. You know, I need a mission. And I even have a mission statement for my life. You want to hear my mission statement?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So my mission in life is to live well, to have fun, and to help other people achieve their greatness. And that really guides all of the decisions that I make. I want to live well. I didn't like living as a starving artist, you know, always being worried that my clunker car would break down, or that, you know, the air conditioning would need fixing, or the heat would need fixing. I didn't like that. I wanted stuff. I've been to seven countries in the past year. The theme for the year for me is adventure, and I want to have the funds and the resources to live my life with adventure. And so, you know, and I want to have fun. So when I was working, you know, how we work in our businesses, and when we first start our businesses, we'll deal with anybody who has a credit card or a checkbook, you know, and even if they're obnoxious, we kind of put up with it. But, you know, at this point, I only want to work with people that I like and that I respect. So that's the have fun part. And conversely, I found that when I got rid of the problem clients, it made room for those ideal dream clients to come my way. And then, of course, the last part of my mission statement is to help other people achieve their greatness. I believe everybody has an inner greatness. They just need a mentor to help them bring it out.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's true for all people. And I wonder how many repressed entrepreneurs are still sitting around out there in corporate jobs that would be hopefully inspired by listening to you today, because I think that's so true. It's really true. There are a lot of people who are just afraid to make the move, and they can rationalize it by saying things like, well, I have three children at home. I've got to save for college education. I need to make sure my retirement's taken care of, blah, blah, blah. And it just goes on. And then they get themselves to 65 or 70 and say, I had some regrets. I really wish I had done something differently. Brings me to the last question I have for you. Would you do anything differently? Do you have any regrets?
Well, what you're talking about is kind of the tyranny of the if-onlys. I never wanted to have that. I never wanted to be on my deathbed and say, if only I had done this, if only I had done that. My regrets are that I didn't really start sooner. You know, that's one of the big regrets that I have, that I didn't really start sooner, because, you know, I didn't really start. I did a couple of things in my 20s as far as entrepreneurial endeavors, but I really didn't get going until I was 30 years old. So I probably would have started, like, people now are starting businesses right when they get out of college. One of the badges of honor right now is to not even go to college, you know, to just kind of skip college all totally and start your entrepreneurial career in your teens, you know, and, you know, say, well, you know, who needs to be, you know, really choked by all of that student debt when I could really start a business and you know, really start, you know, my cash flow and my business career at a young age. And that is such a good age to start entrepreneurship is when you're young and when you don't have, you know, the baggage of a home and a family and, you know, all that responsibility, you know, when, you know, every day can be, as I said, a new adventure for you because, you know, you're not hampered by all that stuff. So that's probably one of my only regrets is that I didn't start sooner.
Well, yeah, I can understand that. And I think today I was just thinking about what you said when entrepreneurs start so much younger. There are obviously business expos all over the country, all over the world, really, where people compete to get the prize, which could be a $25,000 cash plus corporate sponsorships plus all kinds of plus. And the more and more the people who are competing for these prizes are college students and teenagers. And it's just so refreshing to me to see that and to see that they're so passionate about what they're doing. And yes, they're also full time in school. So it's just amazing to me how, as a culture, we are more and more supportive of entrepreneurship, even with at teaching it within high schools. And I just love it. I think it's great because, as you said, there's the if only disease, you know, and you don't want to go to your grave with the if only still onlys. Well, one last question I wanted to ask, too. What area of personal finance do you find to be the most uncomfortable?
It's all uncomfortable for me because remember, I'm the right brain artist doing spreadsheets, doing profit and loss statements, doing all that stuff. I hate it. I just hate it because I'm just not naturally inclined that way. And, you know, my father is an accountant, you know, and he loves that stuff. He loves books and he loves that because it tells the story. The numbers tell a story and you've got to do that. But I just, you know, it's like, you know, when I get back from a business trip, right, and I have to, like, list my expenses and, you know, I'm like, oh, God, please. I put that off until I can not anymore. So that is something that if you can't do it well, just outsource it. But just know your numbers. Know your checkbook. Don't lose control of your checkbook ever. Ever, yeah. You know, don't give anybody the reins to your checkbook, the reins to your personal wealth. You know, a lot of celebrities have these business managers, and I know of one celebrity, and I'm not going to name the name. He was like me. He was a right brain creative. He was an artist and a dancer, and he just put everything on this business manager. He gave the business manager total power over his accounts and everything, and it really worked out badly for him, as it does for a lot of people. But then there's the smart celebrities like Tom Cruise and Oprah who know every check that's written, and that's probably what I would recommend for people is, you know, to never – ever lose control over your finances. Even if you don't like it, it is a necessary evil because knowing your finances, that is your future. That ensures the future for you, for your inner circle, the people that you love, for your family. So, you know, listen to shows like this and really, really know your numbers and know those things, even if it's not your passion.
Well said. Okay, all of you in my Power of the Purse community, these were invaluable insights and perspectives from Linda Hollander, all of which can help you move your career, your life, your relationships, and financial freedom forward. Thanks again, Linda, for your time and knowledge. And I also want to let everyone know that Linda wrote a book called Corporate Sponsorship and 3 Easy Steps. And where can they find it, Linda?
You can find the book on my website, which is sponsorconcierge.com. That's sponsor, S-P-O-N-S-O-R, concierge, C-O-N-C-I-E-R-G-E.com. And can I give away a gift to the listeners?
Please. Please do.
Okay. So if they go to sponsorconcierge.com, there is a gift for you, which is the number one secret to start getting your corporate sponsors. So just fill out the little information there on the site, and you're going to get a free gift from me. And I also love talking with people. So you think you've got a great idea that could get sponsored, you know, for a business, for an event, for a charity, if you would like to write a book, if you would like to do public speaking, you know, well, like I said, we need to talk about our big dreams and how to fund those dreams. And that's where sponsorship comes in. I do free sponsor strategy sessions. So you could book a free sponsor strategy session with me also at sponsorconcierge.com.
Wonderful. And thank you so much again for your time and your knowledge, Linda Hollander. Thank you and goodbye.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us on this episode of the Power of the Purse podcast. If you're ready to take action, go to womenofsubstancellc.com/call and sign up for an exclusive 15-minute one-on-one call with your host, Lynn Evans. Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.